This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. What does it mean to be Jewish in America? For many, it's religion, celebrations, Hanukkah, observance of high holy days. For others, Jewish identity is defined by geography or language. Others consider themselves only culturally Jewish. Well, in the book Passing Fancies in Jewish American Literature and Culture, author Judith Ruderman talks about Jewish identity and explores who passes for Jewish in American literature and culture. Judith Ruderman is a visiting scholar of English at Duke University and a former vice provost at the university and joins us now. Judith, welcome to State of Things.
Glad to be here.
Tell us about the premise of this book.
The premise of this book is not so much who passes as Jewish, but how people over the ages have tried to pass as American. That is to say, how they've been acculturated or tried to be as real Americans, as one character in an early novel says. He wants to be a real American.
And that became an important pursuit. I think we think about the 19th century as this time of assimilation, both in Europe and in but particularly in the United States, as a vital project for many Jews.
Well, there was a huge influx of Eastern European Jews into the country in the late 19th century. Of course, the many German Jews had come earlier. They were already assimilated, as it were, by the time this larger group of Eastern European Jews came. And mostly we think of American Jews as Ashkenazi Jews or Jews from Central and Eastern Europe. But of course, even earlier, starting in the 17th century, we had a small group of mostly Sephardic Jews who came to the United States. All of them had to find their place in the United States.
And in this place, in this United States, which always promoted itself as this great melting pot where people wanted to become American as quickly as they could, in many, many cases, cultures. But this is a particular challenge for a culture that goes back millennia and is strongly identified as the people who remained themselves and remained faithful to their cultural identity through many, many challenges.
And yet, in my book, I talk mostly about the strategies that Jews have adopted and adapted in order to look and sound and dress like everybody else so that they would be acceptable. So, yes, many did. There were negotiations between maintaining your group identity as Jews and forging a national identity as Americans, where you were not always wanted. Peter Stuyvesant didn't want that first group of 23 Jews fleeing Brazil in 1654. He didn't want them, but the Dutch West India Company made him take them. So it's been a constant negotiation throughout the centuries.
And the reason it's a negotiation and identities become important to any group of people at all means that it tells you that it's a group under pressure and that it is facing some kind of oppression and discrimination. And that's why the question of assimilation becomes important.
Yes, many of the Jews who came from Eastern Europe and from Central Europe and the Sephardic Jews before, they did come here because we're supposedly a land of freedom and acceptability. We'll take people. Well, my book interrogates that too.
Well, that's why. I mean, you talk about these negotiations, why you would want to look American, change your name, change your face. This book really started for you in some ways because of the nose job.
Yes.
Well, tell us more about that.
Well, actually, there's a more overarching reason why I wrote this book. And may I illustrate that with a joke? So you may have heard the story about the zoology professor who assigned her students a paper on the elephant. And they could choose whatever topic they wished. And the Frenchman chose the elephant and his mating habits. And the Italian chose the topic, the elephant and his culinary predilections. And the Englishman, hunting the elephant. The Jewish student, she chose as her topic, the elephant and the Jewish question. The point of that joke being that Jews are very often interested in, obsessed with, the situation of Jews. And I guess that's my overarching reason for writing this book. As I look back on books I've written before, I often managed to sneak in a chapter about Jews, even when the author I was discussing was not Jewish.
Which gets to my line in the introduction, those who would pass for Jewish in American literature, because in literature, that becomes a question that sometimes gets turned on its head, right? This question of what is Jewishness?
Well, that's true. Getting back to the nose job, if I may, unless you want me to respond to... Okay, because the nose job really comes from a novel by Nathan Englander. I wanted to add a section to my course on Jewish American literature on authors writing today, contemporary Jewish American authors. And my daughter suggested that I look at Nathan Englander. She liked his first book of short stories, For the Relief of Unbearable Urges. I love the title. I wasn't that crazy about the stories, but I loved his first novel. Set in the so-called Dirty War in Argentina in the 1970s, there are three nose jobs in that novel. And the nose job was not just a nose job. Freud said a cigar is not just a cigar. In this novel, a nose job is not just a nose job. A nose job has something to do with the stereotype of the Jewish nose, which dates from medieval times, if not earlier. And also it has something to do, it's emblematic of all the removals, excisions, and disappearances in that period of time and in that novel. So I wrote an essay on that, which was accepted by a journal, but they had a backlog. And while I was waiting for it to come out, I realized I wanted to talk about the Jewish woman in the nose job, because it's really a question of the female Jew. Yes, I know that in... Goodbye, Columbus, the brother gets a nose job. And I know that men get nose jobs, but by and large, it's a Jewish female issue. And in researching that, I came across a novelette of 1923 where the characters changed their names. By that point, I realized that this wasn't just an article or a couple of articles. This was a book that I had in my mind, and that's how it's... It all starts with the nose job.
It starts with the nose job. Well, and these standards of beauty, which in the case of the nose was established in the 1700s by a Dutch physiologist.
So somebody, when I was once talking about my book, somebody in the audience said, well, really, having a nose job is just an issue of wanting to look beautiful. It's not an issue of wanting not to look Jewish. I was surprised by that response. I said that there's a connection there. What are standards of beauty? Right. They're relative.
Well, and I believe there was actually this standard was written up, right? I mean, it's so many degrees from the brow and
yes,
so many
yes,
yeah. I mean,
it's 17th and 18th century theorists and anatomists, they determined what that was. And of course, the Venus de Milo is supposed to be an exemplar. So one of the books on cosmetic surgery is called Venus Envy. Don't you love that?
I do. I was thinking about the title of the other book that Englander wrote. What was the title?
Well, that one is called For the Relief of Unbearable Urges, but I'm not sure I told you the title of the novel that I love. It's called The Ministry of Special Cases, and that is what got me onto the nose job. But he has written another book of short stories about what do we talk about when we talk about Anne Frank. And he has a very, very recent novel called Dinner at the Center of the Earth. He's very good.
That 1920s novel, was that the Joe Sinclair book that you talked about with the name changes? Which one was that?
No, that is the, you never heard of her.
I'm afraid not. And there's a story behind that because that's a pen name, right?
No, that was her real name. Joe Sinclair, it was in the 1940s, she wrote a novel called Wasteland, which is about name changes.
Name changes.
But this book, this novelette of 1923 is by Thyra Samter Winslow. There's a name to reckon with.
I thought Joe Sinclair's name was Ruth
Yeah, that was her real name.
So she did have a pen name. Yeah, yeah.
She had a pen name, but hers was 1943. And this one with name changes that started me on that subject was 1923. You'd never know from the name I just read you, Thyra Samter Winslow, that she was Jewish too.
Right.
But that was her real name.
And this question, again, of changing identity and how to assimilate becomes a negotiation not only with the broader sort of the dominant culture, but within the community about permissions and approvals and acceptance.
Well, now I kind of end the book with that issue. What is an authentic identity? And that is problematic. I mean, many people, not just Jews of one stripe or another, have felt that they had the right to determine who was the authentic, you fill in the blank there. But yeah, I do deal with that. I guess I'm a little defensive on that point, because as a Reformed Jew, and happily so, There have been cases where, not against me, but where more observant, more traditional Jews have felt that Reformed Jews weren't really bona fide Jews.
Well, let's talk about that, because you spend, you know, much of the first two chapters really doing just that, talking about Jewishness and how many ways that can be expressed.
Yes, yes. Well, it's complicated to be a Jew. Now, it's complicated to be a Christian, too. I mean, there are all kinds of Christians, and within Christianity, they're all kind of Baptists, right?
Yeah.
So it's, but I don't know enough about the Baptists to write about the Baptists. I'm only writing about the Jews. And a lot of people don't know about the different ways you can slice that pie, geographically, Sephardic versus Ashkenazi, but also among Sephardic Jews, we have Jews from the Eastern Mediterranean, usually called Mizrahi Jews, and Jews from Greece call themselves Romaniote Jews, and it's complicated.
Even in observance, right? I mean, you talk about the various levels of observance,
right,
from I think perhaps from Orthodox to Kabbalistic, much more spiritual, and those who would call themselves culturally Jewish.
Yes.
We don't observe, no synagogue for us, but we hang out on the holidays.
And within Orthodoxy, we have the ultra Orthodox, and within ultra Orthodoxy, we have different sects of that name. So it is complicated. And then in that first chapter, I even mentioned the Messianic Jews, the best known being the Jews for Jesus, who accept Jesus as their Savior. And I say very openly, to me, they've crossed the bright line and are Christian, but they would say that's not the case and there is no bright line. So The definition of Jew is slippery, elastic, shall we say.
Elastic. Well, and particularly in a place, in a society, I won't say it a culture, but in a society like ours, an American culture, where there's so much moving about in terms of identity, but so much is at stake in identifying yourself and sort of pouring it into concrete. It's a fascinating paradox, it seems to me, in the United States, how important it is to hold on to your identity in a place where fluidity is apparent, you know, sort of at every turn.
Yes.
Not enforced, I will say. You know, white supremacy is, whiteness is a cultural artifact, and it acts on people in a very real way, and it's not. It's
and, of course, a lot of Jews are not white. We have many Jews of color. I mentioned in the book that it's been predicted that within the next generation, up to 20% of Jews in the United States will be Jews of color. So that complicates the issue, too.
Well, you talk about the book, The Human Stain, right?
Yes.
Tell us more about that book and how that illustrates
Well,
this.
Philip Roth, eventually, you know, one thing led to another in the writing of this book. The nose job led to the name changes, led to clothing changes, and led to people, Jews, passing as Christians and vice versa. And then I had read The Color of Water, and I was so intrigued by this woman who had been born Jewish and from the South and born in Eastern Europe and left and became, as it were, black. So The Human Stain shows the other trajectory of a black man, a light-skinned black man, who passes as a Jew. Philip Roth's novels are always fascinating. They always deal with interesting cultural issues, and that was one of them.
What did you discover as you obviously you were intrigued by the question. You did more and more research as you were drawn in. What observations then did you come to in the writing of this book?
My observations are very blatant to anybody who lives in this day and age in the United States that minority identity is fragile, always fragile, and always vulnerable. We have had police presence at my synagogue for a long time, and that's a very sad statement in and of itself. But until the Pittsburgh massacre in the Tree of Life Synagogue, I never felt quite so vulnerable as I do now. And it's the same with other minority groups. Yes, we live in the land of openness and opportunity, but that's always been in tension
right,
with the opposite, with closed doors, with, okay, we don't want any more of you. And today, we're in vulnerable times.
You talk, we thought perhaps that the place of Jews in American society had been settled, but clearly with Pittsburgh, it is not.
Yeah. I'm sure other groups have felt that they were settled too. Yeah. And maybe they were settled in their community and in their self-regard and in what they considered the regard of their community. And then in a minute, it can be over.
Talk about the paradox of that, though, because you've had time to contemplate this, and it is a paradox that on the one hand, when the dominant culture places you in a position and calls you a name, and it's not, whatever it is, it isn't white, you need to have identity can be a form of protection,
yes,
of psychological
indeed.
And physical protection,
yes.
And support.
Yes.
On the other hand, it singles you out as precisely that thing that is other than white. So do you assimilate and pretend that you are them, or do you maintain your identity as a kind of protection? It does seem to be a paradox.
Well, people try to do both. I mean, most people I know try to do both. Most people who are practicing Jews or cultural Jews, they try to do both. But a lot of artists have raised the question in visual art and in novels and short stories, are you really being foolish about it? Are you really accepted? You think you are, but are you really? And it doesn't take much. In Charlottesville, where my daughter and her family live, it doesn't take much for a group of people to reassert themselves with their bigotry prejudice.
Well, it seems to me that maybe part of the problem, and I'd like to hear what you think about this, is that there is a fantasy that you're going to assimilate into the vision, right, the aspiration of a nation that is blind and colorblind. That's what you want to assimilate to. But that doesn't exist in America. There is no such place. So then you have to default to whiteness, which is discriminatory and holds a lie about its superiority. And if you assimilate to that, you have to accept the whole lie. And there's nothing else here because it's all been fantasy. I mean, that's sort of the
hopefully
problem.
One doesn't assimilate to superiority, but many do. It seems that othering is part of human nature.
What are some of the most fascinating techniques? You talked about this negotiation, and it is fascinating to see how this dance is done. What have been some of the more ingenious ideas that have come to your attention?
Ingenious. Well, that's an ingenious word, and I'm not so sure what's ingenious. It seems to me that they're very logical and commonplace strategies, ranging from you keep your head down to you have your nose fixed, or you get rid of your most orthodox religious practices, or you change your name. And that's not just true of the Jews, obviously. Right. So many people come here and they change their names. And then, to me, the most intriguing thing is how some people in later generations, they reclaim their names. They reclaim these identities that were lost or shunted aside while you were trying to climb the ladder of upward mobility and be acculturated. Then, if you feel comfortable enough, you reclaim them. But I think in this day and age, I'm not sure we feel comfortable enough.
Judith Ruderman is visiting scholar of English at Duke University, former vice provost for the university as well. Her book is called Passing Fancies in Jewish American Literature and Culture. Judith, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank. Appreciate it.